The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.
Unfiltered opinions.
Sometimes you have ideas and you're not quite sure why.
As you secure the bag.
Sometimes you meet people and realize there's probably a reason why you stayed in touch.
Just listen.
Sometimes all the pieces just come together by themselves.
Woo! I'm Jimmy Mayer.
And I'm Simon Brown.
Welcome to Insider Exchange.
Good morning. Welcome to another week. Welcome to another episode of Insider Exchange. We're going to be looking at everything from the trade deal that kind of possibly might have been sorted or not sorted, things around the US interest rates that took place last week, as well as reflecting on where we go to from here, from a market's point of view. We're going to be taking a look at some very interesting movements on the gold front in our deep dive. But we've got a very special guest joining us in studio for this week's Market Matters. We've got the managing partner at African Uriti Capital, Precious Mhlandla, joining us to take a look at market movements, as well as try and understand, if we have time, what earnings to look forward to and what to expect from the market. Before we get to all of those things, a couple of updates from our side. I am Marco this week, spelled M-A-R-C-O. We are continuing to try this. We don't really know how far this will go, but we still haven't gotten that sponsorship. Maybe we should try someone else for the sponsorship. But before we get started, before we get into any of the conversations, you're very old school, hey?
Yeah,
a book, a pen, a paper, a college and a exercise pen. Book. For those listening to our audio, our guest has brought to studio where Simon and I have laptops and tablets. Yeah. He's brought a college exercise book with a pen and notes that look like the doctor has written them.
Well, I'm the only one that can actually read what's here, but there's some formula to the madness. I'm sure it sort of helps the line of thought.
As long as there's method to the madness, right?
Yeah, there is. Like a lot of things that we're seeing in the world these days.
Well, I don't know if there's method to some of the things that we're seeing in the madness, and perhaps that's where we start the conversation, gentlemen, is... I thought we would have a quiet week. I genuinely thought we would have an eventful week, would have CPI data out of South Africa this week, a budget speech next week, and over the weekend, over the course of the last 48 hours, President Trump announces buy stocks and then comes out and says there's been a trade deal. And then just recently, tariffs have been reduced even more between China and the US.
Yeah, so US is now charging China 30% and China's charging 10% on US goods. Effectively, I think it's 115%.
Yeah, 115, yeah.
For the next 90 days while they... Yeah.
So that's a new 90-day...
This is a separate deal.
It's a separate 90-day deal to the other 90-day deal.
Yeah, it is. So, I mean, they met over the weekend... Scott Bessent, I think that's the correct pronunciation.
Yes, U.S. Secretary.
Yeah, the U.S. Secretary. I mean, and there was a leading delegation from China. They met in Switzerland. And basically what they were doing is just ironing out. Look, I think the question was not if the deal was going to happen. It was when it was going to happen. Because, I mean, the pressure on inflation in the U.S. is massive. And labor numbers as well, I think there will always be a lag effect. But at the end of the day, the pause in interest rates last week was actually reflective of that uncertainty. And something had to be done about it. So
the strange thing, I mean, you mentioned those pressures in the U.S. and how they've been affecting the market. And I want to get your thoughts on this, Precious, because I don't think Trump cares about those things. And Sai and I have spoken about this, is he's never cared about what the data says. He's never made the decision based on that. So why the time? I mean, why now?
No, look, if you look at the interest rates decisions last week, basically what the Fed is saying is that there's a lot of uncertainty right now. And two of the critical things that they're looking at is inflation as well as the labor numbers, jobs. So the inflation targeting, effectively what tariffs do is that they're going to increase inflation because that cost, I know the politics that doesn't really sound well, but at the end of the day, the people that pay for increased tariffs are the consumers. So So that number was going to reflect in the US. And what you're also going to see is on the labor numbers, a lot of people are not investing. And ultimately, you're going to see probably even a freeze on new hires. The US labor numbers are coming up this week. So in as much as he doesn't care, I mean, the data was going to force a decision in terms of there having to be a deal on both sides.
Further evidence that Trump does not care was he came out and said Big Pharma in America has been charging Americans way too much money, and now we're going to pass that charge on to the rest of the world and make drugs cheaper in America. So walk me through that.
Drugs in America cost more than they do in other parts of the world. A couple of reasons for that, mostly because they can. And if you can,
and Big Pharma is US-based companies that are pricing that for their own market. Yeah. Why are we being blamed for that?
And Biden was trying to do stuff about it and kept on getting called a communist. Kamala Harris wanted to do stuff about it and got called a communist. But
if Trump does it, he's not a communist.
He is not a communist.
Okay.
Look, we know that Trump's not a communist. He is many things. He might be orange, he might many be stupid, things. He might even be obese, but he's not a communist. Yeah. American healthcare is a mess, and part of that mess is the costs around it, and hence the threat to it. Now, practically how he does it, I'm not sure. I mean, in essence, Medicare and Medicaid, and one of them provides the drugs, I'm never sure which is which, needs to basically negotiate better prices with the pharma companies. But why haven't they before, and why will they be able to now?
So this is the thing. From a Big Pharma perspective, we've all known, there's no secret around this, is companies lobby for position, for power, for policies, for things that they would like. Yeah. And that lobbying is in the form of contributions towards election campaigns and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Do we think that this is potentially Trump being sour than Big Pharma didn't contribute towards his electoral campaign? Or because we never thought about it from that perspective. I mean, you were president the previous administration. You've done this before. This is not your first run at presidency. You didn't do this in your first term. Now, suddenly, it is imperative to do it in this term because we're making America great. Unless, perhaps, we didn't want to make America great the first time around.
No, look, the guy, I'm going to be careful in using the word rules by executive orders. Mm-hmm. There's an executive order pretty much every week that comes down to fix something. It's very knee-jerk in terms of how the reactions are. But at the end of the day, what we need to look at is, I don't want to call it collusion, but a lot of the big pharma pretty much control the market in terms of the pricing of those drugs. And the reaction for him is that, look, you got to wing it and just say, look, it is these guys that are causing you to have expensive drugs in the US. And his reaction to it is, let's put another executive order. Whether or not it's practical is a totally different story. Because I think at the end of the day, it's in the details of the implementation, whether or not this makes sense or not.
From an implementation perspective, aren't pharmaceutical rates and things determined by Congress? Aren't those numbers?
No, not
there was
even.
Something, not the rates. There was something around, and I need to remember it. It was part of the Truth Social post. It was in the comments underneath the post saying that a lot of the decisions that come through from a pricing perspective or federal or something in nature, we'll go back to that. We'll look at that. But effectively, it's a bizarre turn of events to now suddenly, we're making America great again. And that includes going after American companies.
Well, yeah, I quite like your idea around they didn't contribute enough, perhaps. But it's also, I mean, it is a big deal for Americans. They pay a huge amount for Medicare and get B grade. I mean, it's the whole Canada wants to be the 51st state. No, they don't.
Nobody asked for that.
No, because their medical's an absolute mess. But we'll see practically how it works. I mean, the China, the tariff thing, that there's an easy thing. Yeah. It's easy to say we're going to drop these by, 40 to 80%. Mm. Practically, we need to see what actually happens on the ground. Executive orders are, I mean, we can fire off executive orders. We can, you know, say whatever you want. Yeah. Jimmy must go get a haircut, sign an executive order.
Yeah. Whether or not it happens is another
carries
story.
No weight. Totally carries story. No weight.
Huh. Yeah. That's an interesting way to look at it as well. Yeah. But, I mean, from a US perspective, I want to go back to the...
rephrase it. Carries weight. It's not law.
It's not law.
Carries weight because he's the president.
Yes. It is. Yeah. And around implementation then becomes whether or not they take 6 months to do it, 12 months to do it, mm-hmm. those sorts of things. One thing that the markets have been receiving quite well is the news of what happened in Geneva, whether or not that was progressive or not. We saw both sides of that conversation coming out to say we're moving in the right direction. Yeah. Interestingly enough, where America came out and said, oh, we've got the deal, we know what we're doing, we know what we're getting kind of thing and all of that. China came out and said, this is a great first step.
Yeah, yeah.
Almost hinting at the fact that we never said that this thing was, you know, kind of done and dusted. But yeah, nonetheless,
yeah,
the market's loving that.
No.
All markets overnight, Asian markets up, South African futures, UK futures, all markets trading bullish and sign. You were saying that the US futures are trading in the positive territory at the moment.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, the S&P was up, I think it was just about 1%. Mm-hmm. I mean, the European markets that have opened are pretty much all looking very positive. So look, the knee-jerk reaction is that people are looking at this as a positive that, okay, how it ends up, we don't know. But going back to your point around the details, there hasn't been much detail. I think the announcement in the early hours of this morning was that we have a deal. And then they've come back with the 15% that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that means in terms of practically in the next 90 days, nobody knows. But it's a very good positive step in the right direction.
Mm.
And the markets are loving it. I mean, because at the end of the day, the markets don't like uncertainty.
And plus 100% tariffs means that things just shut down.
Mm.
You know, 30%. So there were 20. So now I'm assuming 30 is on top. So there's 50% tariffs on goods coming out of China into America. You can, in many cases, kind of work with that. 145%, you can't work. It's like, it's just game over. What we are going to see is much as we had a pull forward pre the tariffs, we're going to see, I mean, there is going to be, every ship in the world is going to get called to China and take a quick little sail over. Yeah. I mean, it's about 10 or 15 days. You can therefore do, you could do four trips, round trips. There's going to be a ton of stocking.
What's that going to do to the supply chain? Because now,
it's messing it up immensely.
Because in America, in China at the moment, we've seen a slowdown in production.
Mm-hmm.
They've reported that off the back of obviously the slowing tariff uncertainty and all of that. Now, even if China then starts to ramp up production, if I'm China, I don't want to be ramping up production back to the assumption that this is going to be the new production level permanently. I want to see what happens at the end of the 90 days. So I might only ramp up production in the interim or short supply so that you don't have four round trips, so that you only maybe get three round trips out of it, because then that still puts pressure and gives me a negotiating edge in the conversation to then say, you didn't get all the goods that you thought you'd get through in the 90 days, right?
Yeah. So, but if you look at it this way, Jimmy, at the end of the day, what if you're running a factory in China and your client is in the US, right? If you're going to be very, very simplistic about it, you can't replace that customer immediately.
Mm.
So there's production that you've already ramped up that you're sitting
and contracts on. You've already agreed
and contracts
to.
And you've agreed to. And there's a funding cost to that production. So that funding cost, you're carrying it at the end of the day, and you want to get rid of the stock as quickly, as soon as possible, but you cannot immediately pass that on to the customer. So that lag effect is where a lot of people then just start cutting back on, actually, then when you're trying to just see where this thing is going. Now, what does this mean in simple terms is there's obviously a disruption to the supply chain. I mean, if you look at the numbers in April from China, I think it was quite down. The Chinese numbers in April were actually down in terms of trade between China and the US, because everybody's adopted that wait and see.
Mm.
So the challenge with tariffs is, I mean, without meandering much into it, is it's disruptive to planning for anybody that's running any business between the two countries.
Yeah. If you're trying to do, I mean, I was listening to a podcast, a woman who has a clothing business. So she is in New York. She manufactures mostly in China. And she makes the point that the fabric that they're doing, silk and stuff, highly skilled, you can't get it done in America. Needs to be made in China. And she's got shipments which were like, do not send that ship. Like, keep it on the dock in China. I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't want it. Now she can ring them up and say, send
it as soon as possible.
Except that, of course, there's timelines and stuff. And I mean, who knows, you know, fashion. I don't know enough. Much about fashion, but it is challenging. So it's that, and to your point, Precious, certainty. That's exactly. All you want is some certainty. 100%. You almost don't mind what the certainty is as long as you have some certainty.
100%.
And that's been coming through in the markets as well, right? I want to look at market open today in a bit more detail. Sasol at some stage up 8%, and they haven't announced anything spectacular from their perspective. It was largely off the back of positive sentiment in general. We're seeing that.
And Brent's up at 65.50. A week ago, it was sub 60.
It was.
Yeah. Yeah. And the story there is, if we're getting peace, if we're getting, although peace is weird because that might bring Russian oil back onto the real market. Currently, it's still there, just in the black market.
Yeah.
But and if we're getting some sort of stability between the US and China, maybe we don't get recessions this year, and therefore maybe we all need some oil. That said, I got to say, the increase coming in June from OPEC is, I mean, they are pumping and they're planning on pumping even more, and it's going to get pretty wild. But oil is running and Sasol is loving it.
Yeah, and well, look, the beers were talking 50, it went sub 60, like you say.
Yeah.
It's gone back up to like 65, I think.
Yeah,
65. So again, it is that certainty to repeat that will just affect the markets going forward.
Speaking of markets, I want to take a look at some earnings numbers. We have a bit of time to take a look at that. We have seen that some of these companies have been reporting numbers, and even though you're reporting great numbers, the market might not be reacting the way you think. Sai and I looked at Palantir Technologies just last week, reported exceptional first quarter numbers, and the market was just like, we don't care. The share price is going to be down 12% on the first day. And we're seeing, we still have numbers coming out. I mean, we've got Walmart, we've got Tencent, we've got some big companies reporting this week. And the market, I suppose, is also now waiting to see, again, certainty probably comes to mind here.
Yeah, and tech, look, if you look at Palantir, I know you guys looked at it last week. I mean the share price is, I think a year ago was about 25. Or maybe even less. Even less. I mean, it's trading at a huge multiple. So there's that factor. I mean, it's a great SaaS business. They're right on the front end of AI. But again, I think that there's now, you see that with NVIDIA and all these tech companies, that a lot of the stuff is already priced in. So even if they come up with great numbers, the valuations, in my view, I think some of them are way over the top. So you don't get that immediate reaction. But going back to this week, I mean, if you look at some of the numbers that are coming, like for Walmart, so interesting stats. I picked up that Walmart in the last, I think since the 1930s, is the one stock that has consistently gone up in every recession. So those are some of those defensive old school plays that you get. But tech is very, it's funny. I mean, you Nvidia, you sometimes you get numbers out and you think they're fantastic. Next moment the share price doesn't go anywhere, or it actually goes down. So you're seeing a lot of that with tech. I think some of the valuations are a bit rich in my view, but some of the old school sort of defensive plays, you will see some sort of reaction. That's my view around some of these ones. But what we're also seeing, I think I mentioned, so there's Tencent this week as well.
Just some quick fun facts on Walmart. So 1 year they're up 60%.
Wow.
PE's 40. I mean, come on, Costco PE's what, 50? These Americans take their fairly boring defensive stocks and price them.
Clearly.
They do.
Yeah.
Just for comparative figures, and for the audience listening and not watching the show, PE at 40 on Walmart, what's the PE on ShopRite?
Probably 20-ish. Eh? and to be clear, we look at the PE on ShopRite and we're like, okay, 22. So it's half. Let's call it half.
Yeah. Half, but then we also still look at ShopRite trading at 200 and what is it now? I'll tell you now, 284, 285. And we say that's an expensive stock.
And it's growing. It's expected to grow earnings at around about 10%. Let's see what Walmart is growing at. Why can I not spell Walmart? There it is. Walmart's earnings. Okay. Walmart looking about the same sort of high single digit, low double digit growth. But they do. I mean, the Americans expensify things, man. I mean, it's one thing to put Nvidia on a 50 PE, which frankly it's only on about a 30, but to put Costco on a 50,
Let's wrap things up with a look at Anglo Gold. They have been doing really well as a result of that Egypt acquisition, but it's always nice when the gold price just doubles and your cost stays the same, right? Makes for a happy time.
So the stock down 10% this morning, so don't look if you haven't looked yet, because down 10.25%. But I mean, they're free cash flow up sevenfold. Egypt helped. I mean, production was up about a quarter, and that was mostly Egypt. It wasn't that they were mining higher. They managed to keep their all-in sustained cost at around $1,600. That's again because Egypt's a little bit cheaper, so the blend there. And they are going to pay truckload of dividend. And to be clear, this was Q1 when gold hadn't yet gone through 3,000 or the 3,500.
Yes.
These guys are, I mean, I've never seen I mean, I've never seen. I mean, maybe back in the 80s, gold 850 was something. I've never seen gold miners as profitable.
All this happy, for that matter, clearly.
All this happy. They are happier than usual.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you're making so much more money. And that's what we're going to be looking at in our deep dive. We're going to be taking a look at some very interesting developments in the classification of the gold asset under the banking regulations known as Basel III, international banking regulations. We're going to see if we can get Precious to stick around for that conversation as well. He might have to run, but we'll see how that goes. But effectively, we're going to be looking at that from a gold perspective, what that means for the gold market now being classified as effectively a tier one asset and no longer a tier three asset from a reserve perspective. So stick around for that conversation. We're going to leave Market Matters on this note. Thanks, folks, for tuning in. Shout out to our TikTok community for joining us live. We always appreciate your comments and your thoughts around things. But stick around. As I said, yes, we're going to be looking at the gold market. And then in our Investor Insights, we're going to be taking a look at banking charges in the context of two things. One, streaming platforms, and secondly, in the context of the investigations that the FSCA are launching into how much banks charge. But for now, we're going to leave Market Matters on that note. We move on to our deep dive, and we are joined on our deep dive by managing partner at African Uriti Capital, Precious Mhlanhla, to take a look at the gold market. We're going to be taking a look at some very interesting changes in global regulation and how gold is seen as a reserve currency from a capital perspective in the context of the banks. Now, recently it's been announced that as of the 1st of July, so coming up in about a little over a month, under Basel III banking regulations, banks now are classifying gold as an asset, as a tier one asset, as a tier one high quality liquid asset. Previously, it was classified as a tier three asset, which basically meant that banks would be able to hold 50% of the market value of that particular asset in the form of physical gold. Now they'll be able to hold 100% of the market value toward their capital reserves. So big changes from a banking perspective. But what does this effectively mean from a currency perspective? From a country balance sheet perspective.
So it's interesting because, I mean, central banks don't care what you want to call their money. They consider it all liquid. This is for banks, like Standard Bank and stuff. Although
Commercial banks.
That is the word I'm looking for. How much gold did they hold? I mean, maybe they hold none because it was a tier three asset. And therefore, why go buy $100 or something and get credited with 50? That would just be silly.
Yes.
Do banks now rush into the market and buy gold? Because gold is volatile. And it's one thing if you're a central bank. And I mean, okay, we technically have shareholders in our central bank. But, it's fine if you're a central bank. But if you are, Sim Shabalala,
as a commercial bank.
Yeah, and gold goes down instead of up and suddenly a whole lot of your tier one assets get sliced. I mean, do commercial banks want to hold gold? I don't know.
But okay, so here's the question from that perspective is, if I'm a bank and I'm sitting on cash, is it better for me to be in cash or is it better for me to be in gold? Granted, yes, I'd be buying gold at a very high price at the moment. Yeah. And I don't know how much longer it'll remain at these high prices. Is it better for me to be sitting with cash when I'm already, in the context of South African banks, I'm already lending less, right? So I've adjusted my lending requirements and things. So I'm lending less potentially.
Yeah.
I'm sitting on more cash. I'm sitting on more reserves.
Yeah.
What am I doing with that money?
And that's just it. Also, don't you like cash? Because cash has, so if you're Standard Bank and you have ZAR and you lend in ZAR and you report in ZAR and you pay salaries in ZAR and you make money in ZAR, you've got zero volatility in that.
100%. ZAR.
Because it's just ZAR. Now, as soon as you reference it against something else, you've got zero volatility in it. As soon as you add some gold into that, now you've got these moving parts. It's the same with their added US dollars. I mean, sometimes they're going to make, sometimes they're going to lose, but it's those potential swings that are really playing with your capital adequacy. And to be clear, our banks are all overcapitalized. I mean, they've got more than they need. But I mean, if I were a CEO of a commercial bank, I'm not sure that I'm rushing out to suddenly go and buy gold. I think it's nice. I think it's a recognition for gold. But I'm not sure we're going to see commercial banks buying it. There will be outliers, much as we've got MicroStrategy, who's just all in on Bitcoin. There'll be some outliers, but the volatility would scare me.
Yeah, so to add to that point that Simon is mentioning, so right now it's the flavor of the market. I mean, the gold price has actually been going up. Look, it's a store of value, which is the traditional view, but there is an element of volatility. It doesn't go one way.
It's ordinarily what you'd find in the market was that there was an inverse relationship. When the market is going down and everyone is panicking, everyone sort of piles in and then the price goes up. We've not really seen that as a direct correlation. So if it's now a key component of your capital adequacy and your capitalization, those moves have to be repriced. Because if your capital is set at a certain percentage, right? And then the gold price has to move down, then up and down. It's almost like you at what point do you have to buy more, do you have to sell out? So again, look, it is a good thing that is happening. Are we going to see banks piling up from the current cash positions or treasuries that they're sitting on and replacing that with gold? I don't think there'll be a rush. For South African banks, maybe, but I don't think you're gonna find them switching what they're currently holding as part of their capitalization and then buying gold.
Yeah.
They will nibble in and see where that goes, but I don't think there's going to be a wholesale.
What about central banks? Now, we've looked at the commercial banks. Central banks this year alone have added more than 240 metric tons of gold. Yeah. And they plan
to
increase.
Pause there a moment. Metric tons.
Yes. Yes.
That's a lot of gold.
It is.
And they don't plan to stop because there's expectations that, according to the World Gold Council, that we could potentially see central banks, or at least 30% of the central banks, say they still plan to increase that number from where we currently stand. Right now, that comes to the question from a South African perspective around our GFECRA account, the gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account that we've now tapped into to alleviate our budget issues and all of that.
Yeah.
That then means that our central bank could be looking at saying, okay, if we then hold more gold, which is interestingly enough, while we're on the South African Central Bank specifically, while other central banks have increased their amount of gold, the South African Central Bank has not increased the value of gold that they hold.
So I was looking at it. It stayed static for about two decades now at about 125 tons.
Hmm.
Mm. Although, interesting, here's a fun fact, and we must do this one Wednesday. So on Wednesdays between 9 and 12, strictly by appointment, you can go and sell your gold to the Reserve Bank.
Strictly by appointment. Anybody can do that.
On a Wednesday between 9 and 12. First, we've got to buy some gold. Then I think
and then you've got to sell it to the
Central
Bank.
Then we go to Pretoria and sell it to the Central Bank. It'll be fun. We can put a suit on. We might get to meet the minister. It's a beautiful building.
Really, it is.
And then you bring your briefcase in.
And the briefcase.
Yeah, so going back to central banks globally are definitely going to buy. The perception around gold being a store of value has not changed. That's in centuries. You know, the other fun fact is that there's little else use for gold apart from that. It's just hoarding it and putting it in vaults, and that's it.
But also, you look at it from a exchange point of view. When you look at reserves and you look at your trade balance and you look at the surplus reserves that you have, like our contingency reserve account, you then put it on your balance sheet and say that's an asset that we have as a central bank, and therefore, effectively by extension, as treasury, the US Treasury, the Chinese Treasury, our own Treasury, it's used by governments to say that is our reserve.
100%. That has not changed. The bulls are talking of the gold price going to 4,000. The guys that drive the price is not your retail guy. We were having this conversation earlier. It's the institutional guys. So the institutional guys are hoarding it for whatever reason. I mean, and that's also red institution, red central banks. So you're going to find central banks actually buying it and it'll push the price up. But the conversation we're having around banks buying, you're not going to see a wholesale shift immediately where banks are saying as part of our capitalization, we need to replace US treasuries, for example, and then go buy gold.
Because it also locks you into a different kind of, like Si said, exchange rate exposure.
Benefit of gold is its fungibility. And that's over centuries of, you know, we understand what 24 carat and stuff, or 24 is 99.99 and that sort of stuff. That fungibility is really important. You don't get it in oil. You don't get it in agri. You don't even always get it in PGMs and stuff. Gold's got that centuries of it, which is, and silver, but really silver.
Yeah.
And I know there's some of you, sorry, you love your silver. but it is, it's the fungibility. And it is kind of that store of value. It's that volatility, man. You know, it's fine when my Anglo shares are down 10% on a random Monday after reporting giant numbers. But like, I don't know if you want that if you're, you know, a CEO of a bank.
That's going to be interesting to keep an eye on. It's going to be interesting to see how the central bank market starts to look at it as, I mean, not central bank, the commercial bank market starts to look at it from a investor point of view. I mean, we've always known retail investors in various shapes and forms, and even institutions as well, might have a bit of exposure to it, might have a gold ETF here and there. Very seldom do you see a hedge fund say we're going to go buy physical gold bars and build our strategy around physical assets. I mean, we do live in a digital age, they might hold that in terms of a digital value, but the physical side of it becomes a different conversation, which then brings me back to what I wanted to take a look at from a South African perspective around the fact that we haven't increased as a gold miner, as one of the biggest producers of the asset itself in the world. Surely if everybody's strategically piling into that as a government, as a
central bank, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, from a government perspective, right? If everybody's going after the asset and the asset is in your home turf, it is underneath your ground, surely you must keep some of that for yourself. Surely you must just be like, you know what, guys, let's just, we don't know why these people want this thing, but let's just, you know, increase our own reserves.
I agree.
Doesn't that position South Africa in a better position financially?
Sure. Yeah. But apparently not.
Yeah, well, it's not happening. I mean, look, it's not as fast, but yeah. And at the moment, it's the flavor of the market at the moment. Everyone is talking it up. It's been going one way. The price is what? 3,300.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the bulls are talking 4 and whoever is holding
3,200 at futures as we speak.
3,200, So, and the bulls are talking of it going one way. And I suppose what has happened with all this uncertainty, to use that word again, is everyone wants some safe haven and it still retains that as an asset class.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether or not the South Africans are going to make a decision to start buying it, to dig it up through the ground and keep some.
Well, I mean, companies like Anglo Gold and Harmony are already doing the digging. If we go back to Sy's point around passing executive orders for Jimmy's haircut, surely you can just pass an executive order for a certain amount of reserves to be kept in the country. It would be a drastic move by the government, but it would be a protectionist move. It wouldn't be seen as not acting in the best interest of the country.
I agree with you 100%. And most of our reserves are there for US dollars, which is fine. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that dollars should, over the long term, appreciate in value against the ZAR, if nothing else, an inflation rate differential. That's also fine. And that gold is volatile. But you're a central bank, man. Buy up some gold.
Yeah. They feels like low-hanging fruit.
They got 125 tons, right? They sold 250 in the last quarter. Like, went like nothing.
That's what I'm saying. Surely it feels like a low-hanging fruit situation where you can just say, hey, we want some of that here. We're going to... And if you're looking at something like a Harmony that has, you said, an all-in sustained production cost of, what, $1,600?
Anglo Gold.
Yeah. And you as the central bank then show interest in it. Okay, cool. That's what we want to do. And the mining company then says, no, we want to charge full retail because this is what we can get for it outside of the country. Mm. You have two options there, right? You can buy it up or you can tattletale to Daddy Dearest, being the government, and say, we want to buy at a certain price. Mm. Therefore, any South African company can then buy gold at a cheaper price from a South African miner.
Or they can just pay sticker price.
It doesn't really bother people too much around that. Yeah. We're going to leave the gold conversation on that note, folks. We'd love to hear your thoughts around that. If you were in the position of the banks and you had the option to hold gold in physical or otherwise in other forms, would you do that? Is there still value in it for commercial purposes, for trade purposes, for leverage purposes? Share your thoughts, give us your comments around that, and we'd love to hear your take on that. We're going to leave the deep dive on that note. We're going to get into investor insights. We're taking a look at banking charges and the costs associated with certain things like streaming services, but also the fact that the FSCA is now investigating banks for how much they're charging us. So stick around for that. And we wrap things up with a look at investor insights. We're taking a look at the latest news affecting the banking world. The FSCA has decided to investigate banks for how much they charge individuals, but it's also been revealed by the team at My Broadband that South African banks in particular, certain banks charge more for international subscriptions to things like Netflix and Showmax and all of these other subscription services. So depending on the international transaction, streaming services are being charged differently by banks because of how much they charge for online payments and cross-border online payments in particular. Very interesting that South African banks would have, I suppose it's not really surprising, they have varying charges on everything else, so why not cross-border transactions?
It's called that non-interest revenue, hey?
Right.
They need to grow that line.
Where you can stick around and decide this is how much
you're
going to charge.
So non-interest revenue used to be like if you bounced a check or something like that.
Yeah.
Now it's like, oh, no.
Anything is
non-interest. And I'm looking at it, so it's like $3, $5.47, $2.74. I mean, none of it is big numbers, but like really, guys?
So the study that was done by the team at MyBroadband suggests that if you're looking at a Netflix premium subscription at 199 Rand, right? One bank might charge you 4.98 for that subscription. Another bank might charge you a flat fee of 3 Rand, which they've had in place. Another bank will charge you 5.47 Rand. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't seem like a lot. It is what? A 49 cents difference between that. But if you start to think about it, adding up over all of the people that have that subscription across banking clients, that's additional revenue.
And if you think $5, $60 a year for the client. So firstly, for the bank who's got 10, 20, 15 million customers, not all on Netflix, I appreciate, but still. But for you, it's $60, but that's Netflix. How many streaming services? What else have you got out there?
Exactly.
You know, maybe you've got a New York Times subscription. Maybe you've got this,
a Bloomberg subscription, one of those things.
All of those sort of things. And suddenly it's like, which is why, sneaky, sneaky, I have a US dollar virtual credit card.
Yes.
So like when Bloomberg gives me a dollar amount, I don't put a South African bank card in there.
Yes.
Silly. I put a virtual card in there and in dollars. So I pay when it says it's whatever, $20, it is $20.
Yeah. There we go.
So if you look at it in absolute numbers, it looks like it's insignificant. But the bottom line is for the bank, they got a couple of million customers.
Yeah.
It adds up very quickly. So how I would look at it in that the investigation is actually looking at the broader revenue that they're deriving out of those incremental small. It can look like it's 4 Rand here, 2 Rand there. But if you look at it, it's ultimately a huge figure. I mean, it adds to the bottom line if you really think about it. And it's recurring revenue, right?
Yeah.
It's on an ongoing basis every time that you subscribe. So people don't look at it because it's a 2 Rand, 3 Rand. But ultimately, I think for the banks, it's good
it
money.
It adds up.
Coming. Adds up.
And this is probably why the FSCA has announced that they're looking to investigate banks' transaction fees. They made this announcement quite recently saying that they would be taking a look because they, as the FSCA, monitor the conduct of banks as financial institutions. Yes, folks, the banks, while being regulated by the South African Reserve Bank, also hold FSP licenses. And therefore, the FSCA has kind of a bit of flexibility in terms of investigating certain things. They're taking a look at the conduct standard for banks that they had published in 2020. And effectively, that standard kind of governed the banks in terms of how fair treatment works of customers or financial institutions and those sorts of things. So interesting now that the FSCA has decided to look at this and say, we're going to now take a look at whether or not banks are employing unfair practices. And the FSCA in recent times has not been afraid to fine people. They really haven't.
They haven't. And you know what? I mean, look, no one out there loves their bank, I don't suspect.
Unless you're an Investec client, I'm guessing.
Really? I don't know. I still, no, the answer, do you want to be an Investec client, shareholder, or staff member? The answer is staff member every time.
Then
you love your bank. But I mean, the fees are like just like all over the place. Just like all over the place, there are fees. And I mean, let's put some pressure. No, I mean, I don't know. I mean, surely in a free society, you can kind of charge what you want and the consumer decides. And let's be clear, the consumer has decided. We've gone to Capitec. And we've said it before in this show. If you look at the traditional big banks, Nedbank, FNB, Standard, and Absa, they were moving into that private bank space. They're moving up market. And they're basically saying to Capitec and Time, help yourself. We don't want that anymore. Because who can make money in a 5 Rand bank account when Discovery can charge 800 Rand a month? Or Discovery, I don't know what it is, but it's lots. you know, and it's that. But I mean, what authority does the FSCA have to say you're charging too much? Unless there's unfair practices. For example, in the US, if you've got a bunch of debits that go off, they sort them by the highest first. So that if you run out of money, there's all the tail ones, you get more bounces and they charge per bounce. Now, they're perfectly legitimate to bounce when you haven't got money, but if you sort it from the lowest first, you would have less bounces because they charge per denied payment. There's scams like that. And that is just out and out scam. I mean, that is just stealing money because you search that way, not that way. I mean, that is a decision a bank has made that is anti-consumer.
Yeah.
But absent of that, they can charge what they want, surely.
100%. The retail main guide that's just right at the bottom, it becomes significant. If you really think about it, the motivation for it, I mean, we don't know what the conclusion is in terms of whether there is unfair practices or not. But at the end of the day, we should not look at the absolute numbers. But for a retail customer, that's like your typical Capitec, Time Bank client, those small charges that they're being levied across on their bank account become something. Look, for a guy that's running a couple of Netflix accounts and he's a sort of middle income to high income customer, whether or not there's a 4 or 5 Rand taken from from the account doesn't change anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So the motivation is always, it adds up again. I mean, it's for a retail guy, if you get a bounce happening and then you add all those fees up, and some of them are punitive. If it bounces, I think on some of these banks, they will charge you what they call an excess fee or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like a standard 20, 30 rand.
Mm.
Then that they
on a debit order that was 15 rand or whatever
it was.
Order
that was 15 or 190 rand.
Yeah.
So if
they
take another 50 bucks off you and they do it 3-4 times, they've taken 200 rand out of your account.
Yeah. Well, let's see how the FSCA gets on with those investigations. Let's see what they rule on those sorts of topics. And this kind of throws us into our stock pick and our pick for our wall. Our particular pick for our wall this week is off the back of what you said, Si, around the fact that some of the banks in South Africa have elected to forego the little guy, whereas Capitec and TymeBank haven't. And I want to look at a bank in South America, Nubank.
Yeah.
They are the ones that invested in the TymeBank business. They're a big shareholder in TymeBank, but they are also, I think, the largest fintech bank in South America for what it is that they do at the moment.
Yeah.
How do we feel about that?
No, so Nubank is a very interesting, been around for about 11 years. 56% of the population in Brazil, the adult population now banking with them. They've been a disruptor. They went from zero to 110 million customers in the 11 years. Now they're running a TymeBank type model where it's pretty much branchless. So they don't have any legacy cost. So their cost per customer, I mean, I was watching one interview. They're servicing those 111 million customers with 7,000 employees. And okay. A traditional bank would have, for that same number of customers, would have a couple of 100,000 of employees. So very interesting. The results are out this week. They had record revenue last year. They've gone into Brazil. I think they're in Colombia. Can't remember what the other country is.
But in South Africa via TymeBank, effectively. Yeah.
So they're literally banking Capitec guy.
Banking the unbanked. And that's how a lot of the models have been moving. Si, are you liking the stock?
I like it. I mean, it's expensive, but then hello, Capitec. So like it's PE. No, it's PE's 30. So what is Capitec's PE?
Yeah.
30.
Yeah.
To your point. So Capitec, weirdly, is quite branch intensive, but TymeBank not. They use Pick and Pays and the like. I think it looks really, really good. And you know, it's not, sure, it's expensive, but it's in grow up stage. And there is just that South American market. I mean, there's some weird stuff. There's the Amazon of South America, Calibre Cabre, which is just astounding. There's a company in Brazil making their own airplanes, Bombardier. There is stuff happening.
LATAM is one of those markets,
and it's got population, and it's got middle class. It hasn't got the levels of poverty that we have in Africa or in parts of like China and the like. It's got middle class.
Growing middle class. Okay, so that's interesting. We'll add it to the wall. We'll decide if we like it enough to put it... Do we like it enough to put it in our blue chips? I mean, Capitec is blue chip for us.
Yeah, so this is surely not blue chip yet.
Not
it's still
yet.
Too startup.
Okay.
But
okay.
It's in... I don't
like it.
Like it.
Like it. Like it. Okay, cool. So we like it. We're going to put it there. We're going to update that into our wall. It is Nubank. That is our thought on Nubank, folks. It is not financial advice. We are not in the habit of that. You've seen the disclaimers. You've heard the disclaimers. They are on both the audio and the video show. So please don't say that this show gave you financial advice when we actually didn't. We were sharing our opinions and our thoughts. Speaking of opinions and thoughts, it is time for our unfiltered opinion of the week. This one is not something I've thought of. However, I would like to get your thoughts around it because it's quite an interesting statement. I'm going to read the statement. Then I want Si and Precious to give me their thoughts on the statement. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read it as it's been said.
Mm-hmm.
The Pope was chosen in 2 days. Your remote hire doesn't need 5 rounds of interviews. I said what I said.
Hey, I've only ever gone through interviews once, and it was 3 rounds, and it was 1974, and that person is 100% right. The Pope is the Pope's in 2 days, 133, and they want a 2/3 majority. Beep on the money.
Spot on. I mean, look, I think some of this becomes an interrogation. Think about it. You make your decision on first impressions normally. Guy walks in, you like him or you don't. The rest of it, you can train. So why take the poor?
The rest of it, you can train.
The rest of it, you can train.
Exactly.
Good hires are well trained.
That's it.
That's the unfiltered opinion of the week, folks, is you don't need to go through 5 levels of interviews. If you do go through those, give us your experiences. We'd love to know what your best and and worst interview experiences have been? And if you are a hiring manager, do you agree with the statement that things can be trained and first impressions count? That's the show. We're going to leave the unfiltered opinion on that note. Like, subscribe, follow, do all those nice things. But until next time, investing isn't hard. Just try it. The views expressed by the host or hosts in this show do not necessarily represent those of our clients, sponsors, partners, or guests, and should not be considered investment advice in any way. Similarly, the views and opinions of our guests and clients do not necessarily reflect those of our hosts or our platform. Nothing shared on this platform or any other platform affiliated with us should be read and construed as constituting investment advice of any kind on the part of Insider Exchange, any of its hosts, guests, partners, or sponsors. Trading and investing carry varying levels of risk and may not be suitable for all investors. Please ensure that you fully understand the risks and take appropriate care to manage your risk. We strongly advise that you obtain independent financial, legal, and tax advice from regulated professionals and institutions before proceeding with investment decisions.